Welcome to the Saxophone History Podcast, a thoughtful, researched, and slightly irreverent look at the history of our instrument. I'm your host, Andrew D. Meyer. Welcome back to part two of the Lester Young story. When we left off, Young had just quit the Basie band with no real plan put together and basically sort of without the leadership or management skills that would likely be required to make it on his own. While his natural inclinations might have been stacked against him, Young's long-held habit of going to jam sessions around New York meant that he knew loads of players and was able to put together a band in pretty short order. Young opted for a sextet fronted by himself and former Basie trumpeter Shad Collins, and in little time, he had the group booked into Kelly's Stable, a well-known 52nd Street club that would see Young's new group following on the heels of Coleman Hawkins. Unfortunately, one night, less than 3 weeks into the engagement, Young stepped off the bandstand and bumped into a waiter. Apparently, there were some words exchanged, and the sensitive saxophonist walked out, and that was pretty much the end of the gig. That's how he was. He just avoided confrontation, and even something like having words with a waiter on a gig, he would just walk out, and that would be the end of it. Though officially out of work, Young kept busy making the rounds of jam sessions at the Village Vanguard, Monroe's Uptown House, and Minton's, playing casuals, and the occasional recording session, including with Billie Holiday. This was the very beginning of bebop coming on the scene, and while many soloists from the swing era found the new music anathema to their sensibilities, Young reportedly took the new sounds in stride. While Young may have found the new sounds bubbling up in jam sessions intriguing and stimulating, he found the scarcity of casual gigs financially challenging. It was time for a change of scene, which Young sought out by calling his younger brother Lee, who was living in Los Angeles and had been working as a vocalist and drummer with the likes of Fats Waller, Nat King Cole, and Lionel Hampton. He also had a history of working at both MGM and Paramount Studios in Hollywood. It must have been difficult for Lester to call his younger brother, who had stayed close with their father and had taken a different path in life. Lee was an easygoing and businesslike guy who played golf and did charity work. His West Coast lifestyle was a sharp contrast from Lester's habits of skulking around Harlem jam sessions at late hours with hard-drinking Billie Holiday. To make matters worse, Lester and Lee's father, Billy, had made it clear to John Hammond which of his sons he was most proud of. When Hammond called Billy Young to tell him how much he admired his son's playing, Billy was surprised that he was talking about Lester and replied, "Oh no, the great person in my family is Lee." Brutal. When Lester called his brother, Lee was working at Club Capri with the Esquires of Rhythm and offered him a spot in the group pretty much immediately. With the promise of steady work with his brother in his back pocket, Lester and Mary packed up and headed for California in May of 1941. When Lester arrived in California, he had to sit out the six-month waiting period for his AFM union membership to transfer to Los Angeles. During this 6 weeks, he was allowed to perform three numbers per set from the dance floor in front of the band as a special guest artist. It's funny the specificity of the union rules at the time and how different it is now. I'm a strong union supporter and a member here in the UK, but I think anyone comparing the strength of the modern union to its mid-century heyday knows it's been pretty much effectively eviscerated. Anyway, Lee Young's Esquires of Rhythm was a quintet including saxophonist Bumps Myers prior to Lester's arrival. Bumps was a popular player and well-respected by both musicians and audiences alike, and rather than replace him with his brother, Lee augmented the group to a sextet once Lester's waiting period was up. The group built up a strong book of arrangements, including several penned by Billy Strayhorn, who was in town with the Ellington Band. The Esquires of Rhythm featured the futuristic sound of the electric guitar playing single-note lines as a frontline soloist rather than the traditional sort of like Freddie Green style of comping. In effect, this meant the group had a four-piece front with only bass and drums as accompaniment, with the guitar playing lines alongside trumpet and two saxophones. By the end of the year, the Esquires of Rhythm changed its name to Lee and Lester Young's Orchestra, which suggests that Lester made a pretty major impact on the group's success. Lee and Lester were joined on stage by Slim Gaillard and Slam Stewart on guitar and bass. Slim Gaillard was known to be like a really witty lyricist and had a really idiosyncratic way of speaking, very much the same way that Lester Young did. Gelly has a great way of describing what the scene was probably like on the bandstand. He says, quote, "Since Slim wielded a line in verbal innovation as extreme as Lester's, the bandstand at the Capri must sometimes have resembled a latter-day Tower of Babel," unquote. Though he was able to settle into work with a really swinging group quite quickly, life in L.A. was not necessarily easy at first for Lester Young. Much of his family had been living in L.A. for some time, including his father and many of his siblings, cousins, nieces, and nephews. While this was probably something of a comfort, it was probably also very difficult for the shy saxophonist, particularly coming back into contact with his domineering father. The other issue that made Los Angeles difficult was the city's notorious racial divide. Remember, early in his career, Young refused to travel with bands in the segregated South, and now he was in a living situation where it could be difficult to even like walk down the street as a mixed-race couple. His wife Mary was white. This likely led in part to the couple separating and Mary moving back to New York. I think I spoke about this in the Johnny Hodges episode. Remember, the New York branch of the Musicians Union was never segregated, but in Los Angeles, there was a separate union for black musicians. It's not hard to imagine how stepping into that situation would have really rankled Young. In a weird twist of fate, one night, the Lee and Lester Young Orchestra arrived for work at the Capri, only to find that the club's license to operate had been revoked for who knows what reason. Luckily, owner Billy Berg, who was a successful operator and a genuine music fan, was able to set up a new spot within about a week and took the band with him. This new venture was called the Trouville Club and was located in Hollywood, serving clientele like Orson Welles, Bette Davis, Clark Gable, and Lana Turner through, you know, the golden age of Hollywood. And the club was also popular with the thousands of troops pouring through the West Coast on their way to fight in the Pacific Theater. Shortly after the club opened, Billie Holiday was booked in as a guest artist, much to Young's delight. Pianist Jimmy Rowles had a great description of Young and Holiday. He said, quote, "You put the two of them together, it's pretty wild. They'd meet and stop, and he'd say, 'How are you, Miss Lady Day, Lady Day?' And he'd give her a silly look. She'd be saying, 'Hey, you motherfucker,' and she'd back off, and they'd come together, and she'd be hugging him, or they'd just touch, like goldfish or something, like accidental joy, and she was happy all the time," unquote. Though his start in L.A. might have been a little bit tricky with the waiting period and his wife leaving and racial struggles, Young seemed genuinely happy during his time on the West Coast. Gelly points out that 1941 to 42 are often regarded as like the lost years in Young's career because the band didn't make any formal recording and he was on the West Coast instead of in New York where things were really happening, but it sounds pretty great to me. All accounts point to his happiness. He was playing in a great band with his brother. His close companion, Billie Holiday, was around some of the time, and he had steady work. It's easy to forget that, like, you know, maybe that's what life is sort of supposed to be all about, right? Like, just kind of easy and nice. Though the West Coast was not regarded as a serious place for jazz, a major development involving Young occurred in 1942 that would put the Left Coast on the map, so to speak. Norman Granz, who is the future founder of Verve Records, was a young man living in L.A. and working as a junior editor at MGM Studios while he waited to be drafted. He was a big lover of music and a big hater of racial segregation. His bright idea was to set up jam sessions where he could get the best players together and charge the public to come and listen. This might not sound like a major development, but it was important because it was one of the first times that the emphasis was for people to come and listen rather than just having a band for dancing or as sort of background music for drinking. Granz approached Billy Berg at the Trouville, who agreed and let him stage his events on Sundays. this kind of reminds me of like what we talked about in the Paul Desmond episode, where Paul Desmond and Dave Brubeck would have these kind of things at the Black Hawk. It's kind of the same thing with these earlier sessions with Lester Young. The sessions attracted a much different audience than the late night Hollywood crowd. Mostly they attracted like college students and servicemen who were, you know, just genuinely interested in this new jazz that was just being developed by these guys. This jam session format was the perfect setup for Young, who had long had a habit of sniffing out the best jam sessions around. During these sessions, he became friends with Nat King Cole, who often played piano. In 1942, Norman Granz produced a trio record with Lester Young, Nat King Cole, and Red Callender on bass. This was the first record where Lester Young was up front as the soloist and not simply a sideman playing great solos where called upon. It seems weird now, but the idea of a trio led by a saxophonist was very new and definitely not accepted as a standard format at the time. Gelly points out that there were really only a handful of small group records with an instrumental soloist leading the group, and they were pretty much all clarinetists. The record is the first time that Lester Young, or really any jazz player, was playing the whole melody, soloing, and then playing the melody again. You know, kind of the normal way. Usually, prior to this record, a singer would take the melody, or a larger group arrangement would cover the melody, and soloists would fill in behind them, and maybe improvise over part, or sometimes the whole form of the tune. With that in mind, this record really was a watershed moment in the development of the jazz idiom. Aside from these forays into what will become more or less the standard sort of jazz group of the future, Young found great success with the band he co-led with his brother Lee. Even though they didn't record, word traveled far and wide due to their frequent radio broadcasts. In 1942, the band was offered 4 weeks in New York at Cafe Society, which was an unusual venue in that its socialist owner, Barney Josephson, insisted on proudly desegregating his venue. Though segregation wasn't the law in New York, and most entertainment venues were segregated anyway. One thing strikes me as kind of funny about this engagement. The owner was proudly expounding the virtues of socialism and the brotherhood of men and all, but he still expected the band to play from 8 p.m. till 4 a.m. each night. Not exactly egalitarian hours, if you ask me. Still, it was a major step forward for the band to be brought in from the West Coast for the engagement, particularly when their 4-week engagement was extended to 6 months. So Lee and Lester's band was in New York on this great gig and probably sounding better than ever for playing so many hours each night, but unfortunately, 1942 saw the AFM go on strike against the record companies. Surely the band would have recorded while they were in New York, but due to the strike, there are just no recordings from the band during their time in New York. The Youngs headed back to California in February of 1943 for the death of their father, and then shortly after their mother. This was the end of the Lee and Lester Young group, as Lee stayed in California to take over duties as head of the extended family, and Lester drifted back to New York. Incidentally, Lee Young was absolutely a world-class musician in his own right. He toured with Nat King Cole all over the world for 10 years, was the first black musician to be given a full staff contract at Columbia Pictures, and later in life, he became a producer for ABC, United Artists, and Motown Records. After landing back in New York, Lester Young pretty quickly picked up a sideman gig with Al Sears, a tenor saxophonist who had been leading a variety of his own groups. This was a 13-piece band, but it only lasted for a few short weeks. Touring was becoming harder for bands as fuel shortages and other hardships were imposed by the increasingly demanding war effort. Luckily, Sears had wrangled a USO tour for his band, which meant the partial funding would come from the State Department, and that would make things easier, not to mention the guaranteed bookings. This tour lasted for several months until the autumn of 1943, when Young found himself adrift again. He had this pattern of getting on a gig, going out on the road, and then drifting back to New York to the jam sessions until another offer would come along. It's like he would, you know, he'd go out on the road and then he would just kind of wait it out in this pool of musicians around Harlem. His next one would be to briefly rejoin Count Basie to cover for Don Byas, who was unwell. Byas was a pretty heavy drinker and also prone to basically just like acting like an asshole and offending all of his bandmates. And Dave Gelly points out that Lester Young's return to the Basie Band caused quite a stir, which was sort of in contrast to the relative obscurity in which he was existing when he wasn't on one of these high-profile gigs. He had accumulated a fair bit of fame, but mostly he just sort of existed in the shadows when he wasn't on one of these tours. It was like, you know, he comes back in the Basie Band, and that's like, that's big news in the jazz world. But then when he's not making those kind of headlines, it's sort of like, yeah, he's just, you know, he's just jamming and doing his own thing. Interestingly, at this time, Lester Young sort of had one foot in the older style of Count Basie and the other tours which he was playing on, and one foot in the futuristic bop world. He was regularly attending jams at Minton's and Monroe's in Harlem, and joined Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk at the Onyx Club on 52nd Street. Ultimately, he would go back to the Basie Band to replace Don Byas, who had been fired for drunkenly waving a pistol around one night. Apparently, Basie just told Joe Jones to go find Young in a popular after-hours spot for musicians and get him to rejoin the band. Jones claims that he just came in and told him what time to be at the gig the next day, and that was that. Lester Young rejoined Basie just as if he had been there all along. Young's return to the Basie fold really turned his prospects around. His return coincided with the end of the recording strike, meaning that Young was back in the studio for the first time in a few years, even though Basie's label, Columbia, was one of the last to settle their dispute. Due to the wartime restrictions and just general entertainment trends, the Basie Band was no longer traveling quite as hard as it used to, and it was usually staying sort of in one location for at least a week, rather than doing endless strings of one-nighters. This meant that there was ample time for small group recording, and indeed there are many recordings of Young with piano, bass, and drums, or as part of a sextet, septet, etc. Basie appeared under the name Prince Charming on some of these sessions for contractual reasons. It sounds like the musicians from his band had a lot of opportunity to get their ideas on tape or wax or, you know, whatever they used at that time. In 1944, Young did some sessions for Keynote using the exact same band he had recorded with 5 years earlier as the Kansas City Seven. This same setup, as well as his notable recording absence during the strike, served to show a clear change in his sound and playing style over that time. Over those 5 years, his sound took on weight and became more husky. His vibrato became more robust, and he favored the lower register more frequently. It's hard to say what caused these changes exactly, but his playing had matured and become more serious, often eschewing the lightness of his youth. 1944 brought Young to the West Coast with the Basie outfit, where he encountered Norman Granz again. Granz had managed to sell the idea of a short film about a jam session called Jammin' the Blues to Warner Brothers and was eager to sign Young up, along with Joe Jones, Harry Edison, and Dickie Wells. It's a black and white film of the group playing a couple of pretty relaxed tunes. It's kind of like an early music video, and a rare chance to see these early jazz players filmed in like really high quality. The tempo picks up with the third tune, and there are some neat visual effects, like double camera shots and some dancing as well. The film is also where that really famous black and white image of Lester Young with the, a pork pie hat, I think, with the hat on, and he's playing, and he's got that cigarette in between his first two fingers on his left hand. That's where that image comes from. And the film is available on YouTube, and it's definitely worth spending the 15 minutes or whatever with. It was nominated for Best Short Film in 1944, which, by the way, was the year that Casablanca won Best Picture, by the way. I kind of wonder why jazz musicians don't do stuff like make short films like this anymore, really. Like, maybe we should be making videos that are more than just nicely staged concerts. I don't know. Have a look. See what you think. I think it's cool. While things were going great with Young creatively and professionally, there was a dark force that had been following him around, the draft board. It was quite common for musicians to just ignore notices from the draft board in those days by simply saying they were out on the road and didn't get the letter. This is before email and cell phones and all that, so pretty reliable method, I guess. However, That could only last for so long, and one night a very strange guest showed up at the plantation club in Watts, where they were playing. He wore a zoot suit and a low-hanging chain like Cab Calloway, and after the set, he bought Lester Young and Joe Jones drinks all night. He got them, like, good and drunk, and then he pulled out his badge, and he said to be at this address by 9 a.m. tomorrow, or we'll come and take you to jail for 5 years. The young musicians must have been quite shocked, but they weren't particularly worried because they assumed the army wouldn't want to take anyone with Young's drinking habit and Jones' eccentricities, but they were wrong. The army was no doubt confused, if not outright suspicious of Young's appearance and behavior when he showed up. Keep in mind, he's wearing an ankle-length coat, dark sunglasses, a pork pie hat, and talking in his own semi-comprehensible language. Further, when asked if he drank and used drugs, Young freely admitted to drinking large quantities of whiskey and smoking cannabis regularly. The army sent him into the medical examinations, which showed that he suffered from epilepsy, was tremendously unhealthy, and had also contracted syphilis at some point. The army doctor decided Young should receive a spinal lumbar puncture, otherwise known as a spinal tap. And this put so much fear into him that he had to be kept in a padded cell overnight. You can just imagine these, like, super straight-laced army docs seeing this guy come in looking like he's from a different planet. And he might as well have been, really. Lots of guys, particularly young African-American men who may have felt that they didn't really owe their racist country anything, would have been coming in and pulling all sorts of stunts to try to be declared unfit for duty. So who knows? The army docs might have just thought, yeah, here's another one trying to convince us he's too weird for duty. At any rate, Lester Young was inducted and shipped off to Fort Arthur, California for basic training. In what might have been the least surprising thing of all time, Lester Young was not a good fit in the army. In fact, he did what he had always done when faced with an overwhelming situation, and he ran away. Lee Young was about to start his night's work at the Downbeat Club one autumn night when he spotted his brother Lester lurking around in the wings. Lee, realizing what had happened, quickly hustled him into his car and drove him back to Fort Arthur and helped boost him over the wall so he wouldn't get busted for going AWOL. Young was shipped off then to Fort Ord and then finally to Fort McClellan in Alabama. I'm sure that being forced to be in the army and stationed in the South in one of the most racist states must have been awful for him. While at Fort McClellan, Young was required to complete an assault course as part of his training, right? You know, like the classic thing you always see in the films. It must have been quite amusing to watch this spectacularly unfit man attempting to navigate the obstacles. But unfortunately, Young managed to fall so hard that he had to be kept in the base hospital for some time for what is only described in his records as minor rectal surgery, whatever that is. He was sent to the camp psychiatrist as well, who concluded that Young was in a, quote, constitutional psychopathic state manifested by drug addiction to marijuana and barbiturates, chronic alcoholism, and nomadism, unquote. The doctor also decided that whatever the problem with Young, it was purely a disciplinary matter, not a medical one, and sent him on his way. I guess that's the state of mental health care at the time. Several days later, the captain from Young's unit found him looking rather unwell and asked, what's up, man? What's going on with you? Always one to tell the truth, Young told him that he was high and showed him the pills that he had taken. The captain got the company commander, and the two of them searched Young's effects, finding pills, cannabis, and some alcohol, which resulted in his arrest for possessing habit-forming drugs without a valid prescription. At Young's court-martial, it came out that the Army Draft Board knew that he was using drugs and alcohol heavily and was therefore not a suitable recruit, but took him in anyway. In short, they had made a mistake but refused to back down. No surprises there, right? Further, the Army had not allowed him adequate time to rest after his injury before sending him back to training. The verdict was guilty anyway, and Young was dishonorably discharged from the Army and sentenced to spend a year at the military prison at Fort Leavenworth. Unfortunately, Young was sent to Camp Gordon, Georgia, to begin his sentence. This was undoubtedly a worse sentence, a worse place to be a black prisoner, in a southern jail. Young rarely spoke about any of this series of unfortunate events, and a lot of this information came out due to a Freedom of Information request made by Downbeat for a 1981 article. And one small spot of comfort was that Gil Evans was stationed in a nearby military hospital where he worked in the dispensary, and he would occasionally bring Young cannabis and whiskey, like smuggle it into the jail for him. Upon his arrival back in Los Angeles after this ordeal, Young's only comment was, "I'm out. That's all that matters." Upon his release from the Army, Young signed a 3-year record deal with Philo, negotiated by Norman Granz while Young was still locked up. Miraculously, Young went into the studio early in 1945 sometime and produced a wonderful result, despite having just survived what was likely the worst year of his life. Indeed, the tune DB Blues, named ironically for the Camp Gordon detention barracks, is buoyant and full of lightness in its swing. In addition to negotiating his record deal, Norman Granz was tremendously helpful in getting Lester Young's performing career going again. Granz organized a series of concerts called Jazz at the Philharmonic that eventually became a tour as well. One of the first Jazz at the Philharmonic shows was, it was actually the first time that Charlie Parker and Lester Young would appear together on stage. And the touring version featured both Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins, as well as Buddy Rich. Though his record label and his benefactor were in California, New York was the place that Lester Young really wanted to be. This time, Young was a bit more professional in his attempts to get his own band going. He signed with an agent called Mo Gale, who managed the likes of Cab Calloway and Ella Fitzgerald, and then set off on his usual pattern of finding bandmates at New York jam sessions. Young's new band began a 1-month stand that quickly extended to 2 months at Chicago's Hurricane Lounge. This band had less in terms of arrangements worked out and relied on their shared feeling for the blues, more like the Kansas City kind of riff stuff. As Gelly points out, many have assumed from the stripped-back nature of these arrangements that Young just walked on stage every night and called tunes with little thought for arrangement. But he points out that this isn't really the case, and that many of these tunes feature multiple modulations, which indicated that, you know, they would have indeed been worked out in advance. In 1946, Lester Young met and married his next wife, Mary Berkeley. She, much like Young himself, was a very quiet and reserved person who was probably better suited to Young than his previous wife, who was quite volatile. Unfortunately, the experience with the army and the detention barracks had left Young quite damaged. He struggled to trust anyone, particularly white people who he didn't know. He refused to eat in restaurants and instead insisted that food be brought to him backstage or in his hotel room. Luckily, Mo Gale, you know, his agent and manager, realized that Young was pretty much useless when it came to the sort of day-to-day running of a band. And so he hired Charlie Carpenter to be Young's personal manager and assistant. With the bookings coming in from Gale and Carpenter handling the day-to-day, Young's group came to be quite a success. I don't know where I heard this, but I once heard someone say, the music business is two different things. Meaning there's the music side and the business side, and those are two different things. This group of Lester Youngs is a good example of what can happen when both aspects are, you know, taken care of, unlike his previous effort, which was musically sound but not managed well. Through 1947 and 1948, this group toured the entirety of the United States, drew sizable crowds, and was paid handsomely. In 1947, Mary gave birth to little Lester, and the family moved into an address on 140th Street in Harlem. It was an area that was quite prosperous, and it was called Stryver's Row. Though Young was having quite a bit of success with his new group and managed to move successfully into the bebop era, which many of his contemporaries struggled with, there was something of an undercurrent of complaint coming from the jazz cognoscenti. They wanted him to play like he did in years past with Count Basie. Naturally, this was a source of irritation for Young, who was, you know, in a pretty tough spot. He was one of the few of his generation who could actually hang with young bop players, yet people like John Hammond complained loudly and publicly that his old style was preferable. No wonder he drank. Young was also doing the jazz at the Philharmonic concerts during this time, which paid very well and would have allowed him to stay in the finest hotels wherever they went. But Young preferred to stay in small, black-run hotels on back streets to avoid any trouble. There was never any chance of racial trouble on Norman Granz's watch, as he steadfastly refused to play for segregated audiences or to play for anything except, what he thought his artists deserved, no matter their race. At times, the group would travel on private planes, even. The financial stability that these concerts gave allowed Young and his family to move out of their Harlem apartment rather shortly and buy a house in Queens. As the 1950s came, Young's health suffered, and though he was continuing to play the big Jazz at the Philharmonic concerts, it seems his heart wasn't really in it. The concerts had gotten to be big affairs, tending toward fast tempi with screaming trumpets and, just not really Lester Young's wheelhouse. It's said that his best moments came each night when he was featured on These Foolish Things or I Cover the Waterfront, his ballads. In 1952, he made his first tour abroad in Western Europe and Scandinavia, which was a rousing success, though Young seems to have enjoyed himself more in the jam sessions on the Left Bank in Paris. It seems Young was bored with playing the same routine each night on these tours and was drinking more and more as a result. Unfortunately, the story gets a bit bleak, a bit sad from here. After a disastrous recording session following a 1955 Jazz at the Philharmonic tour, Young collapsed in a nervous breakdown and was taken to Bellevue psychiatric ward by his wife, Mary. He remained admitted there for about 2 months on a treatment of rest, regular meals, and abstention from alcohol. Upon leaving, he was feeling lifted and ready to get back to playing. He would never have his own group again, but casual solo gigs and package tours were still aplenty. Young would also feature with the Basie Band throughout the 50s, though typically in more like one-off concert-type settings, like at the Newport Jazz Festival. These sort of dates were the high water mark for Young in the 50s, and both he and his audiences found them enjoyable. Unfortunately, the low points were also getting lower as the 50s wore on. His reputation suffered as his alcoholism became common knowledge, particularly after an epileptic incident on stage at Smalls was wrongly attributed to his drinking. Coleman Hawkins was quoted as saying, quote, "That Lester Young, how does he get away with it? He's stoned half the time, he's always late, and he can't play," unquote. It's quite a brutal quote, and it's especially mean-spirited, if you ask me, considering that, Hawkins would have been well aware of Young's struggles at the time. Touring the big concert promotions soon became too much for Young, who was suffering from the effects of alcoholism, malnutrition, cirrhosis, and his teeth were a mess, and this is in addition to the epilepsy. He was generally confused and depressed, and it's also likely that he was suffering from the tertiary stage syphilis by this point, which can manifest itself as sort of like general clumsiness, a staggered gait, confusion and depression, and chronic pain. It's unknown what the state of his syphilis really was at the end, but it had been quite a number of years since he was diagnosed at the Army induction, and people that were around him say that those symptoms seem to match, what they were seeing in his day-to-day life. Possibly knowing that the end was near, either from his syphilitic brain or from his chronic drinking, Young left his wife and kids in their house in Queens and took up residence in a hotel overlooking Birdland on 52nd Street. He explained this by saying that he needed to be closer to the center of the action, which was the excuse repeated by his wife Mary. It's likely that this was just one more example of Lester Young running away from difficult and emotional troubles. In the Alvin Hotel, Lester Young became more isolated. He would stare out the window, drinking and watching the musicians show up for work at Birdland each evening. Max Roach and others were kind enough to discreetly pay his bills, but there was little that anyone could do about his condition without his consent. Luckily, Marshall Stearns knew a jazz-loving psychiatrist and physician named Dr. Luther Cloud, who was patient enough to sit with Young for a few sessions before suggesting any sort of treatment. Eventually, the doctor did manage to get him to slow down on the drinking, eat some food, and also take some vitamins in order to put off the inevitable for a couple of years. With Dr. Cloud's gentle but persistent efforts to get Young turned around, slowly the saxophonist started feeling better. He began to talk coherently, get dressed, and even began to leave the hotel on occasion. As his physical health improved, he wanted to play but found that his manager, Mo Gale, as well as his day-to-day assistant, Charlie Carpenter, had both written him off as unreliable and possibly dead. He was feeling better but really still in no state to try to put together and run a band, which was something that he had never really been great at in the first place. Help came once again from Marshall Stearns, who recognized that 1958 was exactly 30 years after Young started his professional career with Al Bronson's Bostonians. That was in 1928. In other words, it was the perfect excuse for a sort of celebratory, retrospective kind of showcase to be called simply 30 Years in Show Business. Stearns negotiated the date with Oscar Goldstein, the manager at Birdland, who was happy to book the show, but refused to meet Stearns' $100 a night fee for Young. Stearns felt really adamantly that Lester Young should get $100 a night for these shows, and in the end, Stearns paid Young $50, and Birdland paid him the other $50, so he did get his $100 fee. The gig was a great success and made it known that Lester Young was back, much to the surprise of those who had seen him incomprehensibly babbling and refusing to get dressed and just in this drunken stupor only a few months earlier. He played 3 weeks at Birdland, and other gigs started coming in as word got out. Most of these dates were more or less vaguely in the New York area or Newark. And under the watchful eye of Dr. Cloud, Marshall Stearns, and a few other close friends, Young was able to stay healthy enough to keep up with his obligations. Then, an offer came in to play the Blue Note Club in Paris, and then join on a Jazz at the Philharmonic tour after that engagement. This was frankly a tall order, as it meant that the sensitive and quite fragile Young would have to fly to France alone and live there for a couple of months without any of his support network. Though it definitely wasn't the best idea, the prospect of international recognition was too much. Young made the trip without incident and settled into the gig really well. He found stability and compatibility with his rhythm section, comprised of pianist René Utreger, bassist Pierre Michelot, and drummer Kenny Clark, and guitarist Jimmy Gourley. Unfortunately, this wasn't to last. The pianist and bassist couldn't stay on with the group, and Young found their replacements to be substandard. Without any of the people who had been keeping him on the, you know, relatively straight and narrow in New York, he started drinking again. March 2nd, 1959 would be Young's last studio effort. He went in with his Paris bandmates, but the results were pretty dire. He couldn't very well hold a pitch steady, and his shortness of breath meant that he was unable to make phrases that really lasted. Gelly describes the way he sounded as, quote, "He utters mere contingent fragments. Nothing connects with anything else. Strength has departed from lungs and fingers. Mind is at the end of its tether. Spirit is slipping away," unquote. After 7 weeks at the Blue Note in Paris, Young could play no more. He had extreme pains in his stomach and could barely manage to get out of bed. Not wanting to see a French doctor or go to a hospital, Young played his last set on Friday the 13th of March, and the next day packed up his things to go home. Young was suffering from varicose veins in his esophagus, which had ruptured and started bleeding. By the time the plane took off, he was vomiting blood and in incredible pain. There was nothing that he could do but wait out the grim 8.5-hour flight. By the end of the flight, the pain had gotten so bad that he'd bitten through his lip. A couple of days later, at 1 in the morning on March 15th, Young awoke in a drunken haze. He began to fumble around, and a doctor was called, but it was too late. By 3 a.m., he was dead at just 49 and a half years old. The scene of his death was apparently sort of suspicious. I mean, he's in this cheap hotel, you got a bloody-faced corpse. This woman that's with him is just like frightened out of her mind, and it was so suspicious that the police were called. They took everything of value, including his well-worn Con 10M tenor saxophone, but returned everything to his wife Mary once the story had been checked out. Just one more bit of sadness in what I'm hoping will be the most depressing episode I ever do. Lester Young's funeral was a well-attended event with many of the biggest names in jazz present. Billie Holiday showed up and wanted to sing, but she was hammered, and Young's wife recognized the state that she was in, and she wouldn't have it. Billie would die within 4 months as well. Lester Young is buried in the Evergreen Cemetery in Queens. As with a lot of these stories of great saxophonists, the ending is a bit bleak. I thought it might be a nice way to end to just talk about his influence on future saxophonists, as a way to realize that though his life was difficult and came to a somewhat miserable end, Lester Young's brilliance lives on through generation after generation of great saxophonists. It's no secret that the Lester Young Coleman Hawkins split in the family tree of saxophonist genealogy is one of the first major stylistic differences to emerge in jazz music. And it's certainly no secret that the influence of Lester Young can be traced through many, many saxophonists right up to today. Al Kahn recalled that when he first heard Jumpin' at the Woodside and Dark Rapture, that he was so transfixed that he switched from clarinet to saxophone overnight. He also recalled how Young's light and nimble sound sounded so effortless and fresh to his ears. His influence extended beyond the saxophone as well, with Miles Davis saying that he learned the, quote, running style of playing with a softness in the approach and concept and places emphasis on one note, unquote. Though his playing had a major influence on the likes of Stan Getz, Al Kahn, Zoot Sims, Lee Konitz, Jerry Mulligan, and on, Young found much of the imitation to be unnerving. It's likely that he felt they were imitating a younger and happier version of himself, particularly those who picked up like his mannerisms and his way of speaking, and he found this to be off-putting. Aside from his musical legacy, Lester Young is often credited with inventing some of the most common jazz slang. It's said that it was Young who first used the term bread to refer to money. And Gelly also speculates that Young was the first to use cool as a term of approval, though I find that one a bit harder to believe. Young was certainly a colorful wordsmith. He would say he felt a draft if he sensed racial prejudice, and he referred to the police as Bing and Bob, and people's wives and girlfriends as pound cake. So that's pretty much it for the Lester Young story. As usual, I'd like to leave you with a couple of recommendations before we finish of things maybe to check out. First, I'd like to recommend that short film that Lester was in called Jammin' the Blues. It's available on YouTube, and it's definitely worth a watch because it's just really high-quality footage of Lester Young playing. And it's also just a really cool example of artsy, interesting stuff that Hollywood used to put out. Another one, there's an opera, actually, called Prez, a jazz opera by Bernard Cash and Alan Plater. That was produced by BBC Two in the UK in 1985. But I haven't been able to find it anywhere, so I'm recommending that someone else finds it and send me a link, you know, if you can. again, I'd like to point out the primary source for this episode just one more time. It's called Being Prez, The Life and Music of Lester Young by David Gelly. It's a really great book, and Gelly knows Lester Young well. He wrote the liner notes to the complete Lester Young Studio Sessions on Verve box set. And as far as musician biographies, I feel like it's on the shorter side and really readable, so I'd really recommend it. One thing that Gelly does really well is describe the form and content of Lester Young's recorded solos, and particularly the early ones. And he has some really great insights into Young's playing, as well as a lot of other stuff that, you know, didn't make it into this episode. So again, definitely worth checking it out. On a side note, I got the Kindle edition, and I don't know if mine has a glitch or something, but every time Count Basie appeared, his name was misspelled as Count Basic throughout the entire book. I don't know why that happened, but I just thought it was pretty weird, pretty funny. That's it for the story of Lester Young, and please get in touch if you have any comments or anything that you want to quarrel about. Some people have gotten in touch, and I've had some nice feedback, and I really appreciate it. As always, I'll post some sources on my website. That's andrewdmeyer.com. And thanks very much for listening to the Saxophone History Podcast, and I'll catch you next time.